Well, thank you all very much for coming this evening. It's a very great pleasure to welcome you here to the Divinity School and to the Bodleian Library, where we've been having Crime Day. I hope you had a chance to take a look at the exhibition case that's just out in the Proscolium, where we have a number of examples of material from our collections displayed there. We have quite an extraordinary collection of material that relates to detective fiction and to crime. Some of my favorites are Raymond Chandler, not because I'm a big Raymond Chandler fan, but we have notebooks that have the phrases that he's collected to insert into his fiction as he's writing. So he would note them down, keep them in a neat little notebook, and then when he was stuck for a phrase, he'd go back and dive into this notebook and pop them in. I don't know if you do that, Val, but maybe something to think about doing that. And it's been really wonderful to have them. The Bodleian has 9 million volumes, and we're adding at the rate of about 1,000 items a day, still flowing in, even in the digital age. We're getting that many pieces of paper-bound volumes in a day. And why is that? That's because Thomas Bodley, who established the library, or re-established in some respects, because Duke Humphrey's library above us was from the 15th century, then was sort of laid waste to, and Bodley came along and re-established this library in 1602. And he must have been just an incredible person because he was full of ideas. He said he had his network of honorable friends who were going to help him rebuild the library. But in 1610, he went to the Stationers' Company and said, here's a deal I'd like to have. Let's have a copy of every book that's printed or published in England come to the Bodleian. And that is really the nucleus of our great collection. The fact that we've been able to do that over centuries means that about 50% of our collection has come on what is now legal deposit. It was formally created as legal deposit in 1710. And what that means is that material that is not regarded as academic at one time turns out to be of extreme interest to academics in a later generation. And that's why we have actually so much crime fiction that people might regard as leisure reading and not the subject of scholarly work. But just let's put that in perspective. The Bodleian is known for getting rid of its copy of Shakespeare's First Folio, because it was not regard, you know, the third edition came along and people said, oh, there are new plays here, so let's get rid of this first one. And in fact, Bodley wasn't so sure he wanted fiction in the library anyway. So I just mentioned that as we're talking about a popular subject, and I'm very happy to have people come to the library and have us open our doors for people to realize that the Bodleian encompasses, it's a very big tent the Bodleian is, and we have that. Now it's my great pleasure to introduce Val McDermid to you. I suspect that you don't need an introduction, and that's really why you're here. But some of the things that I'm just learning as an American is that Val is a graduate of St. Hilda's College, so she's an Oxford graduate, and that she was the first pupil from a state school in Scotland to come to Oxford. To St. Hilda's. Oh, just to St. Hilda's. All right. Well, good enough, don't you think? You know, but to think that. And she has gone on to be one of the most successful crime writers of our generation. She had her first success as a novelist with Report for Murder, which appeared in 1987. actually already a distant 22 years ago. It's kind of shocking, 1987 thing seems like yesterday. And she's gone on to receive numerous awards, including the Gold Dagger, which is something very, very notable. I'm sure that most of you will have seen the acclaimed television series, Wire in the Blood, starring Robeson Greene as her most famous creation, Dr. Tony Hill. And she'll be signing, and you don't have a copy here in front of you, no. Fever of the Bone, which just came out on the 10th of September. So that will be a real treat for people to have something that's fresh blood, I guess we might say. So we're very privileged to welcome Val McDermid here tonight, and I'll turn that over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you, Samuel, for making me so welcome here. It's more years than I care to remember since I swore not to bring fire into the library. I can tell you, I haven't brought fire with me today. But hopefully there'll be some fire in my belly when it comes to speaking to you. I feel very honoured to be part of this Crime Day, because P.D. James has been one of my personal heroes for a very long time in this field, and I was privileged already to read her book talking about detective fiction, and I know that it's a book that I'm going to go back to over the years. It's a tremendous sort of summary of the field and also very thought-provoking in lots of places. And I thought that in the general theme of Phyllis's monograph that I would talk really today a bit about what crime fiction has meant to me as a reader and as a writer, what the genre was like when I came to it 22 years ago as a writer, and where it is now, and what the possibilities are for the future. And I suppose really I should start with my own journey as a reader. Now, I grew up in Scotland, on the east coast of Scotland, in a very working class family. My grandfathers were both miners, my dad worked in the shipyard, and it was a time really before mass market paperbacks, and books were a luxury that we couldn't afford. But I also came from that kind of working class culture that believed education was the way for your children to have a better life than you'd had. And so I was always encouraged to read, I was encouraged to get an education. And my mother used to take me to the library from really as soon as I could talk. In fact, before I could talk properly, I used apparently to say we were going to the Labrador. But for me, the great stroke of luck in my life was probably that when I was 6 years old, we moved house to live opposite the Central Library in Kirkcaldy. And this became my home from home. The librarians were extremely generous with their knowledge and their time, pointing me to lots of different books and not laughing when, again, my sort of spoken age kind of went beyond what I could read. I'm eternally grateful to the one who didn't laugh at me the day I came in and asked if they had any more of those nice Norse leg ends. And of course, being Scotland, still back then in the Presbyterian 1960s, although you could take four books out at a time, two of them had to be non-fiction. I mean, heaven forfend, you should have unmitigated pleasure. And really, this limitation on the number of books you could take out, which I believe now no longer exists, was one of the reasons why I came to crime fiction. As for me, I used to spend a lot of time with my grandparents at weekends and in school holidays, and I would always run out of library books. And they lived in a little mining village that was too small to have a library. They had a mobile library that came to visit, but because I didn't, my life was so bound up by rules and regulations, because I didn't live in the village all the time, I wasn't allowed on the library bus. So I'd be like a kid at a sweetie shop, but I'd be peering in at the library bus going, all those books. And I wasn't allowed on. I got my own back, though. I got my own back last year when I published a book called A Darker Domain, which is set in Fife. And I spent a day on the library bus going, na, 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 I'm on the bus now. But I always used to run out of things to read. And my grandparents were not readers by any stretch of the imagination. I think their lives were too busy just existing to have time for such frivolity. But they had two books in the house. It's a bit like Desert Island Discs. They had a copy of the Bible, and they didn't have a copy of Shakespeare, but they did have a copy of Agatha Christie's The Murder at the Vicarage. And so whenever I ran out of things to read, I would read The Murder at the Vicarage. And linguistic scientists tell us that Christie's language is very simple and very direct, and actually if you have a reading age of 9, you can read Christie with comprehension. And I was quite a precocious reader, so I think probably from about the age of 8 onwards, I was reading Agatha Christie, and I loved this book. I loved the story, I loved the mystery, I loved the subplots, I loved the way everything tied in together. So that even though by the second or third reading I knew what was coming, it was still, the journey was interesting. And I think also, I think kids have a capacity for repetition. I don't know if any of you have small children or grandchildren who have done that thing with the DVD where you have to watch the same film or the same episode of Thomas the Tank Engine every bloody night. You know, and then they say things to you like, do you think Gordon will crash through the station wall, Mummy? And you go, well, he has on the previous 97 occasions. I think it's likely that he will again. But there's still that pleasure in watching it happen. And so I was enjoying Agatha Christie, and I realized from this page at the beginning of the book that there were a lot more of these books. So I thought, well, I need to get my hands on these. But of course, they were in the adult library. And the adult library was like, you know, forbidden land. It wasn't allowed into the adult library until I was 14. And I'm thinking, well, I can't wait another 5 years for the next lot of Agatha Christie's. And so it drew me into my own, I suppose, first life of crime. I stole my mother's library tickets. And I would go over to the library and say to the librarians, my mum's not well, I have to get her a book. And so by this devious method, I managed to work my way through Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers and Niall Marsh and Marjorie Allingham and Conan Doyle and pretty much any crime writing I could get my hands on. But if there is a single theme that runs through my standalone novels, it is the sense that the past always catches up with you, that your sins will find you out, that crime committed is never crime got away with. And indeed, my past did catch up with me a few years ago when I went back to Kirkcaldy Library to do an event for them. And my mother, who still lives opposite the Central Library, came with me, of course. And I introduced her to a couple of the librarians who remarkably were still there all these years later. You know, I mean, as a child, I thought they were absolutely ancient. I mean, there must have been at least 23. But as I introduced my mother, one of them looked somewhat taken aback and said, oh, Mrs. McDermott, I thought you must be dead by now. And I was like, what do you mean, dead? And she said, well, with you being a bedridden invalid for all those years. And, you know, my mother gave me that look that only mothers can give, you know, that wait till I get you home look. But what this did, I suppose, was that all through my teens I was reading these books, and of course eventually I discovered the great sources of secondhand bookshops and jumble sales for extending my own personal library. And as I was, you know, working up to reading my degree in English at Oxford, I was of course reading great English literature, but I was also all the time reading crime fiction. And alongside the great works of English literature, there was always a crime novel on the go. And some people might think that coming to Oxford would be something that would pour a bucket of cold water on this enthusiasm, because, you know, you might now be able to go to university and do a degree that incorporates detective fiction, but you certainly couldn't then. I mean, when I read English here, English literature stopped in 1945, and that was that. But what I found very interesting, really, was that you'd go into your tutorial and there'd be piles of books everywhere, books on the shelves, too deep, books stacked on the floor, books on tables, books on chairs, books on cats. Everywhere there were books. And always amongst these academic texts, above the proceedings of the PMLA, or the sort of Early English Text Society's edition of Gawain and the Green Knight, would be the familiar green and white spines of the classic Penguin crime novels. So although we might not be studying crime novels, it was certainly made clear to me by the reading of my tutors that it was intellectually respectable to read them. So I didn't feel that this was a sin that I should cease and desist forthwith. I felt that I could just carry on reading this stuff that intrigued me so. And I suppose that these adventures in crime fiction had become sort of much deeper and wider than those early days. I had been introduced to the Americans by an English teacher who had recommended Raymond Chandler to me, and from Chandler I went on to read Hammett and Ross Macdonald. I can still remember actually sitting under the great copper beech tree at St. Hilda's one afternoon in 1974 reading my first Dashiell Hammett. It was that sort of shocking and surprising a read. It was quite unlike anything I had read before. But of course it was very, very different from the English crime writing genre. I still enjoyed the English novel, it has to be said. And I can still remember my first encounters with P.D. James and Ruth Rendell in the 70s. I've heard P.D. James described as a cozy writer. And every time I hear something like that, it puzzles me. Because there is nothing cozy about the world that Phyllis creates for us. I can still remember the absolute shock of Shroud for a Nightingale. If you've read that, you'll probably remember the scene I mean. One of the most horrific scenes I have ever read in a crime novel, involving a stomach feeding tube and a bottle of bleach. And it still sticks in my memory, that scene. It makes the hairs on the back of my neck stand up just thinking about it. This is not some cozy St. Mary Mead world. This is quite a different environment altogether. And side by side with this, Ruth Rendell was taking the police procedural in, I think, probably more political directions than it had before in this country. But all the same, when I came to the point of actually sitting down to think about writing a crime novel back in the early 1980s, there wasn't a great deal of choice about the kind of book you could write in terms of the English crime novel. We had essentially detectives who were either police officers or they were amateurs, like Miss Marple. And there was a tremendous respect for the law and for the status quo. This was by no means a revolutionary literary form. This was very much a conservative form of literature, where there was no equivocation about what would happen to the murderer at the end of the book. They would be handed over to the police, they would be punished, they would be dealt with. And I suppose I found this quite limiting in a way. We did have the first inklings of maybe a different way of approaching the crime novel, other than just the straightforward detective novel. There were, I think, early examples in the work of Patricia Highsmith, and in a very different way, Josephine Tay. I think both Highsmith and Tay were really interested in the psychology of crime, particularly the psychology of abnormal behaviour, people who are driven by desires other than the straightforward one of my wife's having an affair or I want to get rich, so I'm going to bump off my rich relative. In the work of both Highsmith and Josephine Tay, I think you can find a sort of different approach to the crime itself. And although they had very different moral positions, a kind of sense that sometimes people are almost captive of their own psychologies. There's a sense in which they're driven to do the things that they do almost by an internal motor that it's very hard to fight against. And I think following on from those early roots, Ruth Rendell, with her non-Wexford books in particular, had started to plough the same furrow, the notion of the psychological involvement in crime. But still, the overwhelming majority of what was being produced was essentially of two kinds. There was the police procedural and the village mystery. Now, for me as a potential writer of crime fiction, there was a big problem with this. I didn't know enough about the way the police operate to contemplate writing a police procedural. I had the sort of notion at that point that you really needed to know what you were writing about. I didn't realise then quite how much we make it all up as we go along. And the other thing was that the police officers I had met as a baby journalist had not filled me with a burning desire to spend enough time with them to find out exactly what they did do on a daily basis. So that was kind of closed off to me. I really thought, I can't do this. I don't know enough about what I'm talking about. I'd also spent too many years without a television, not watching crime on the telly, to be able to just pick it up as I went along from that. And the other thing was the village mystery. Now, this again posed tremendous problems for me. I had grown up in a village a lot of the time, but a small mining village in the east coast of Scotland was a very different proposition from St. Mary Mead. We did not have retired colonels of the Indian Army. We did not have spinsters with herbaceous borders. We had wee women that were dragging their men out of the pub at closing time on a Friday night so that they wouldn't spend their entire wages on drink, which didn't seem to feature largely in Miss Marple's life. And we didn't even have vicars, because we had ministers. So I had a real sort of difficulty here in actually finding something to grab hold of that could form the basis for my attempt at a crime novel. And then I suppose my epiphany came from an unexpected direction. Someone I had been at St. Hilda's with had gone off to work in America after university, and she came across a book that was published in America that she thought I would enjoy. So she sent it to me, and it was Sarah Paretsky's first novel, Indemnity Only. And this book, to me, was like the light bulb goes on in your head moment. Here was a novel that had an urban setting. It wasn't set in some sort of little village where everybody knew everybody else. It was set in a kind of big city that sort of throbbed with the kind of life that I understood, that was related to the kind of places that I knew, the kind of place I lived at that point. It was a novel with a strong female protagonist, and a very, very different protagonist from Miss Silver or Miss Marple. A woman who had agency, a woman who had a brain and a sense of humor, a woman who had a role in the world, a woman who was prepared to be David against the Goliath, to take on the big organizations, the big institutions. And I also loved the fact that it had politics in it. It had personal politics, but it had a wider sense of social politics, of the possibilities of a novel with big scope, that you were writing about much, much more than a little crossword puzzle about somebody that died in suspicious circumstances. You were actually writing a novel that, where the death itself almost grew out of the social circumstances. And this, to me, was a kind of revelatory moment. And I thought, this is the kind of book I want to write. And I didn't know if it was possible. I didn't know if I had the ability to write that kind of book, but I knew it was what I wanted to be able to achieve. But what I also knew was that, for me, at the heart of the way my mind worked, because of all these years of reading crime novels, I wasn't convinced that at that stage that I could write a private eye novel. I wasn't convinced that a private eye novel would work in the UK. And so I knew that I was going to be writing something that had the kind of form of the classic detective novel, although it had this gloss of being a very different kind of character and a very different kind of setting. So I started off my career writing three novels featuring a journalist called Lindsay Gordon. And I mean, Lindsay Gordon is the first lesbian detective in British crime writing history, or the first openly lesbian detective. I'm sure there were others before, but they were just in the closet, you know. But Lindsay, people, because she's a lesbian detective, people think of these books as sort of somehow, you know, sort of like this first wave of, you know, sort of radical lesbian feminist crime fiction. Actually, if you peel away that surface, what they are is classic Golden Age detective novels. They follow all the rules. You know, you've got your cops who are too stupid to find out what's going on. Lindsay, who is the amateur sleuth, is drawn into the crime because she knows someone who's been killed, or she knows someone who's been accused, or she happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. She conducts various interviews of various sorts. She follows clues. She invariably makes some catastrophic mistake along the way. And then finally, she arrives at the truth and exposes the villainy of what's gone on before. So as I say, beneath this sort of superficial gloss of being something sort of feminist and political and different, they're actually quite the same. And then with the Kate Branigan novels, which is where I went next, I thought by that stage that it was time I tried to see if it was indeed possible to make the private eye novel work in the UK. Raymond Chandler famously said once that whenever he was stuck for what was going to happen next, he'd have a man walk through the door with a gun. Now, I have to tell you that this does not work in a British crime novel. Not even in Manchester, which was known in the 1990s, amongst other things, as Gunchester. But I was interested to see if, with a very different set of social mores, I could make the private eye novel work. And so I carried on writing those and writing the Lindsay Gordons alongside. But this was not enough for me. I wanted to stretch myself further. I wanted there to be more possibilities. And I suppose I was very lucky to start writing in the genre at a time when it was transforming itself. The crime novel had gone beyond those narrow confines that I saw when I was starting out. And there were writers who were picking it up and sort of shaking it and looking at it and seeing what they had. And very, very different kinds of novels were starting to be written. Ruth Rendell had transformed herself into Barbara Vine and begun an extraordinary series of novels which have in common, again, that sense of what I was talking about earlier, that notion that whatever you do in the past, you cannot escape it. Your crimes will come and cast their long shadow over your life, and your life that you have carefully knitted up after the terrible thing you have done will start to unravel before your eyes. And those Barbara Vine novels, I think, were quite different from anything that anybody else was doing when Ruth Rendell started to do that. And for me, they were revelatory because, again, it was an opening up of possibilities, what you can do with this genre, the things that you can attempt, the places you can go. Other novelists were also doing very different kinds of things in this country and in America. Minette Walter's first novel, The Ice House, again, took the sort of sub-genre of romantic suspense into a whole nother place. Nobody really, since the Victorian novels of sensation, had dealt with romantic suspense, or since the turn of the century, when you had your Anna Catherine Green writing her Had I But Known, Dear Reader, novels of romantic suspense. And Minette took these to a different direction, in a different plane, made it very much a contemporary novel, a novel of contemporary manners and mores. The Ice House works because it draws exactly on the expectations we have within the social units that we live in these days. It wouldn't work in the 30s, and it might not work in 20 years' time, but it was absolutely on the money for the time and place that it was set now. And as I say, it brought this whole notion of the romantic suspense novel, The Woman in Jeopardy, right back into sort of front and centre, and made it something that just exploded with possibilities for the here and now. In America, again, there were writers doing some very different and extraordinary things. Thomas Harris had written Red Dragon and then Silence of the Lambs. And this, for me, was my first introduction into the world of the psychological profiler, which, of course, had profound effects for me in my later writing. And also, Patricia Cornwell had written the first Kay Scarpetta novel. Now, let's just put to one side the later excesses of Kay Scarpetta and think about those first three novels and how extraordinary they were when they first came out. Kay Scarpetta was a medical examiner. No one was writing about that particular forensic speciality in that way before Patricia Cornwell started in the 1990s. And I contend that those first three novels are three of the best thrillers that were written in the 1990s. So as I say, put the more recent ones behind us and let's just focus on the height of the achievement and the way that that changed the world, the way that that changed the landscape for all of us. For me, Thomas Harris was probably the most personally interesting of those writers. The notion of using forensic psychology was something that had never occurred to me before. And when I read Red Dragon and then Silence of the Lambs, I was very intrigued by the possibilities of what this might lead to. And certainly for me as a crime writer, it was interesting because I liked the way that it allowed us to probe inside the mind of a killer. Because what's always interested me as a novelist is character. Why people do the things they do. What drives us into the situations where the only possible response seems to be murder? Why would your mind work in that way? What has gone into your makeup to make you that person? What is driving you right this minute into that act? All of those things were at the forefront of my mind as a writer. And when I read The Silence of the Lambs and Red Dragon, I could see the possibility of using this in the investigation of crime. So I started finding out all I could about profiling. My partner would say, you know, other people get to go to bed at night with someone who's reading a nice romantic novel. I get to go to bed with someone who's reading the FBI Handbook of Sexual Homicide. As indeed I was. Gave me some very good ideas now. There's a great country song going off at a complete tangent. I think there's a great country song to be written. You know, if I'd killed her when I met her, I'd be out of jail by now. But that's another story. So I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, well, what are the British police doing about this? Are we using profilers? Are we training people in this art? And I started making some inquiries, and I discovered very quickly that we, in fact, do things very differently over here, or at least until recently, we did them very differently. And that instead of what the FBI and the Mounties do, rather than taking police officers and training them in behavioral psychology, what we do is take clinical psychologists, the kind of people who deal on a daily basis with the inmates of secure mental hospitals, and have them work with the police. Now, I thought this was interesting in two senses. I mean, it was interesting, one, because here was a profession that wasn't the traditional route of crime investigation and that was going to bring something different and fresh to the whole idea of looking at a crime. But the second thing, and what for me has turned out probably to be the most powerful thing, is that the police are always naturally suspicious of someone being brought in from the outside. The police are a very closed society. They don't trust outsiders. And so immediately you have a kind of dynamic tension going on between the profiler who's brought in to help and the police who are not quite sure whether to trust them. And that relationship sometimes overbalances when the police decide that they're not going to go with their prejudices, they're going to really embrace this and go for all it's worth. And I think we saw the negative side of that in the Rachel Nickell case, which some of you may remember. But I thought there were huge potential possibilities here for me. And so that for me was the sort of opening door that led me to Tony Hill and Carol Jordan. Tony, clinical psychologist who helps the police by profiling. Carol Jordan, who is very, very good at the things that cops have always been good at, but also smart enough to understand that there are things she can't do. And so the times when Tony Hill can bring an expertise to the game that they need and that can't come from anybody inside the tent. So those books, again, took me in a different direction as a writer. And as I said, it's been a very fertile time for crime fiction. The last 20 years have been extraordinary. I think for those of you in this room, I mean, you're presumably here because you like reading crime novels. You're here because you're interested in the genre. And isn't it amazing how much there is out there? How the possibilities have expanded almost before our eyes? You know, I talked about the psychological explorations here, but what there's been so many other different areas that people have explored. We've had legal thrillers, those novels that work so well in America and so badly here, which I think is possibly something to do with the different way that the legal systems work. But it's hard to imagine a writer like Scott Turow being able to adapt those dramatic cliff-hanging legal thrillers to the British system. People have tried, and there have been some noble attempts, but I don't think really that anyone has really mastered yet the courtroom drama in the UK. So that's a field that's possibly open to be exploited. It's entirely possible that there is a chance out there that someone can find a way to make the drama that was, if you remember the Crown Court television programme, which was always so dramatic and exciting, maybe there's a way of transforming that into a novel, but I don't think anybody's quite cracked it yet. What also has become a hugely popular field is the historical mystery. In her monograph, Phyllis posits that it's hard to have a detective novel at a time when you don't have a police force. But I think, I mean, she admits herself that is given the lie to some degree by the amount of historical crime novels that take place well before there was any kind of formal official police force that was part of a function of the state. I mean, we've got stuff going back to ancient Rome and ancient Egypt. Apparently, according to the Crime Writers Association guidelines for their historical dagger award, history ends at 1970. So if two-thirds of your book are set before 1970, it qualifies as a history mystery. But we've had every kind of figure from history now turned into detectives. We've had everything from 9th century Irish nuns through to Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. And to me, it's extraordinary. I'm never quite sure when I open a book who's going to turn up as the detective next. You know, is it going to be the Mary Queen of Scots murders? I'm going to find that Mary was secretly running her investigations behind the arras. So there does seem to be immense possibilities here. I must put my hand on my heart here and say I'm not the greatest aficionado of the history mystery, partly because I feel that too often we apply modern concepts of morality and the sense of guilt to the crimes of the past and to the society of the past when perhaps different criteria would be set within society for the pursuit of crime and criminals. However, a lot of people like them, and some people who do them well do them extremely well indeed. And then we come to the whole field of forensics, which has exploded, and not just in the CSI sense. Don't start me on CSI because it's not pretty. My view on technology is that it's useful and it's a tool like anything else when you're constructing a story. But it's very easy to fall in love with technology, and it's very easy for the book suddenly to become about the technology. And then by the time you get the book out, the technology's moved somewhere else, and boy, do you look stupid. But it is fascinating stuff. I have a friend who's started off as a contact and has now become a friend, Professor Sue Black at Dundee University, who's the professor of anatomy there. And she is by trade a forensic anthropologist. And whenever I ring her up or whenever I meet her for a drink to talk about something or to ask her a question about something I need to know for my next book, she's always full of something interesting and something other, you know, and it's always really exciting stuff. The last time I saw her, it was freckles. They'd just convicted a paedophile from a photograph on the internet from the pattern of the freckles on his arm. And so these forms of identity and identification, this photograph on the internet, the police had a suspect. She was able to demonstrate that the pattern of freckles on your arm is unique to each individual. And this guy was convicted on the basis of a picture of his arm. You know, there is no hiding place anymore, or so it seems. And forensics have become, the different disciplines of forensics have become fascinating. We've gone, from forensic anthropology to forensic zoology, A to Z. We've got forensic genealogy, we've got forensic entomology. All of these different disciplines that can be drawn in and brought to apply to the science of uncovering crime. I think often these are very interesting disciplines to do in one novel. But when you try to force a series out of the forensic genealogist, I'm not quite sure if you can make that work. For example, in one of my standalone novels, I have a criminal profiler, but she doesn't do the kind of stuff that Tony Hill does. She does the number crunching stuff. She does the geographic profiling. She does the algorithms. She does the probabilities. It all comes, stuff she puts in the computer and stuff comes out the other end. And this, for me, was fascinating for one book. But you can only say so much about algorithms. You can only say so much about typing stuff into a computer. And so for me, I did it once, and so the fascination has been, if you like, has been fulfilled for me. I don't want to do any more of those unless the technology changes in such a way as to become very, very interesting all over again. So I think we have to be aware of the temptations of getting seduced by the charms of technology. But it is, I will say, it has been an interesting source of material for many of us. Of course, what we also have is regional forms of crime writing. You know, the Scots have now been, you know, for a few years now, we've been doing what they call tartan noir. And I do think there is a kind of common thread among Scottish crime writers like myself and Ian Rankin, Denise Minor, Christopher Brookmeyer, Louise Welsh, Stuart McBride. And what we all have in common, I think, is a fascination with the dark side of the human psyche. And a thread that runs through all their books of very black humour. The Scots have always laughed at death. And we've always made sick jokes about the circumstances in which people die. The more unpleasant the circumstances, the better the jokes generally. I certainly found that when I was a journalist. And what I also now starting to see is the emergence of what I suppose we're going to have to call emerald noir, as the Irish discover crime writing. Something which also I think backs up another point that Phyllis makes in talking about detective fiction, when she says that it seems that the crime novel is essentially a Protestant art form. And it does seem to be the case. Excuse me. I've had a couple of weeks of too much travelling. And too much breathing other people's air and germs. And I swear, it's just a cold. It's not the swine flu. Okay. Yeah, so I think it's interesting that crime fiction did start, by and large, in Protestant countries and has tended to reach its apogee in non-Catholic societies. I think it's interesting that we see the emergence of the crime novel in different European countries, kind of based on when they got out from under the thumb of Catholic theocracy. So the French and the Belgians were kind of the first, a much more secular society. The Italians have started to follow, and now finally the Irish are throwing off the yoke of many centuries of rule by the Catholic Church and starting to produce some terrific crime writers, writers like Ken Bruin, Declan Hughes, and Alan Glynn, who's got a fantastic new novel coming out, just to talk about in the middle. What we also have seen, as well as these regional variations, we've seen novels written from practically any kind of viewpoint, the viewpoint of the detective, of course, the viewpoint of the bystander, the witness, if you like, the viewpoint of the killer, and even in the case of Alice Sebold's Lovely Bones, from the point of view of the victim. It seems that it's possible to write these novels from any perspective. We've seen the crime novel used as a way of exploring moral questions, moral issues. For myself, this is one of the things that has interested me in some of my standalone novels. In Killing the Shadows, I think one of the things that's at the heart of that book for me is the question of to what degree is the artist responsible for what may happen as a result of their art? Should we take a responsibility for the way society is in terms of what we write? I don't know the answer, by the way. If someone has, could they put it on a postcard for me? In another of my standalone novels, A Place of Execution, one of the questions that exercised me during writing of that book was the notion of capital punishment, was the notion of is this ever justified? And one of the things that has obsessed me, I suppose, through all of my books, if there is a single theme throughout them, it is the gap between justice and the law. How often the law goes through its processes and gives us a result, but it's a result that does not make us feel that justice has been served. How do we deal with that? How do we process that? How do we bridge that gap? How do we come to live with that, or not, as the case may be? Interests me all the time. Another aspect that I suspect we're going to see a lot more of in the coming years, because it takes a wee while for, by the nature of things, the books to catch up with the rest of us, is financial thrillers. I imagine that the events of the last 15 months will produce a welter of novels attempting to tell us what really went on, or to tell us, give us a different take. To perhaps not all of them will have bankers as the villains, but I suspect there'll be quite a few. Interestingly enough, I just mentioned the Irish writer Alan Glynn, whose second novel, Winterland, is just about to be published. And given where the world must have been when he started, it's a remarkably prescient novel, and it's, I think, a very, very interesting novel that tells us really about what happened to Ireland when it discovered greed. So we're also getting these financial novels, and we're getting political novels, but novels that are overtly political. Novels like Liam McIlvany's All the Colours of the Town, which is set in Glasgow and Belfast with a background against the Troubles, which explores these issues of our recent history and brings them very much to the forefront of a contemporary crime novel. We have, as I mentioned earlier, more and more European novels reminding us that, you know, we are all part of the European project now, whether we like it or not. And it's interesting for us to find out what our contemporaries in Scandinavia, in Iceland, in France, in Germany, in Spain are thinking, because so often the crime novel is today the novel of social history. We have taken up the mantle that the literary novelists walked away from when they became obsessed with literary theory in the 80s and the 90s. We don't care about Derrida. We care about the reader. We care about text in the sense of involving the reader in story, because I personally think we are hardwired for narrative. We love things that have a beginning and a middle and an end. And the crime novel has that par excellence, though not always necessarily in that order. So it seems to me that, you know, Phyllis has given us a fantastic overview of where we are up till now. And the place we are right now is a place of endless possibility. It's a place of endless fertility. People talk about the 1930s as being the golden age of the crime novel. But I think that we are very, very lucky right now, because we have still got class acts like Phyllis and Ruth Rendell, Reginald Hill, among us, still producing fascinating, interesting, engaging work. But what we also have is a tsunami of young writers coming through with something to say and deciding that the crime novel is the way that they want, is the vehicle they want to say, to talk about the society in the way that they want to talk about it. For me, it's fantastic, because I can stand here today and know that whatever kind of book I want to write, whatever story I want to tell, there will be a way to tell it within this genre. there will be a way to tell it that that does involve the big things, the things that matter, life and death, desire and despair, pain and joy. These are all the elements that make up a crime novel. And for me, it's that endless possibility that has made this journey so much fun this far, both as a reader and as a writer. And I fully anticipate will make it as much fun until I reach the ripe old age that Phyllis has reached. So that really is pretty much all I have to say this afternoon. And I'd like to give you the opportunity now to ask any questions that you would like to ask. I'm going to say, excuse my coughing. And if no one asks any questions, I will be forced to pick you out at random as if it were a tutorial.
I just wondered how you felt about, you personally, about having your work adapted for television. Is it is it an ultimate compliment for a crime writer, or did it translate well from the character that you created in your mind and, you know, on paper to how it is on television?
I think most writers would agree with me when we say that adaptation is not necessarily a compliment. It's a route by which you hope to bring more people to your work. And I think the key element is being very, very careful who you trust with the adaptation. I have seen too many of my friends' work being turned into very poor television or really crappy movies. And I was very, very careful about who I was prepared to work with on the adaptation of my books. I'd had several approaches for the Tony Hill and Carol Jordan novels, and I'd always said no because the people concerned seemed to me not really to get what I was trying to do or not really to be in tune with my work. But the first time I had a meeting with Robson Green, who stars in the series, and Sandra Jobling, who is his business partner and the executive producer of the series, I could tell right from that first meeting that these people were very much in tune with the books, that they really genuinely liked the books, and that they wanted to do as good a job as they possibly could in bringing them to the screen. And we had several conversations, and we hammered out the things that we all felt were the key elements that had to make their way onto the screen: the complexity of the storytelling, the character of Tony Hill himself, the ambience in which the stories take place. And with that in mind, I sent them off and said, basically, make as good television as you can possibly make. I see every draft of every script, and I am expected to produce, to do notes for the script editor, who passes all the notes onto the writer. So they get a bundle of notes, that some of which come from the director, some from the producer, some from me. And they don't know which notes are whose, so they don't have that sense that I'm standing sort of looking over their shoulder. I hope they don't anyway. And we use a lot of the same writers again and again. And when a new writer joins the team, the first thing they're sent off to do is read all the books. So I think what we've ended up with is a TV series that feels like it occupies the same fictional landscape as the books. I think if you see the TV and come to the books, it's not some sense of dislocation and vice versa. And I think Robson Green actually has been a terrific Tony Hill. He was very much physically like the Tony Hill in my head, to the degree that I now cannot any longer see my original Tony Hill. But interestingly, although Hermione Norris did a fantastic job of playing Carol Jordan, she's not replaced the Carol Jordan in my head, because physically she's not like my Carol Jordan. So I still have my Carol, but I am stuck with Robson for Tony. Which some people would perhaps not regard as a hardship. Yes, lady here.
I just wanted to ask, Val, in quite a lot of your novels, the violence that is portrayed is really extreme, stomach-turning, and I'm sure that's your intention, to make us feel revulsion. But is there a risk of actually desensitising your readership? And can you go any further with some of the portrayals of horrific crimes?
I think the issue of violence is an interesting one, and it's quite a vexed one. For myself, I have a very clear idea in my head what is too far and what is enough to achieve the result I want to achieve, which is, yes, you're right, in some cases it is to disturb the reader. The crimes I write about are not the bloodless crimes of Agatha Christie. They're not resolved in that kind of way either. And I think that sometimes, particularly with the Tony Hill and Carol Jordan novels, it's necessary to be very direct about what violence is and what it does. I mean, I have said before that if you read these books and you're not disturbed, you probably do need to seek professional help. But it's, I think it is appropriate to write about violence very directly in certain kinds of book. And in that segment of my work, I find that it conveys the shock of this kind of crime in a way that nothing else can do. I think it is... I don't believe you have to keep on sort of upping the stakes to still provoke sort of that moment of shock. I think you can often do it in quite small ways. It depends on the book, it depends on the killer. But there's another kind of practical element with the Tony Hill books, which is that Tony is a clinical psychologist. His job is to read the crime scene and to profile the killer from the crime scene, to try to figure out from what he is seeing the kind of mind that finds this a satisfactory exercise. What is it, therefore, he's always asking himself, what is it about the particulars of this crime that reflect the particular mind behind it? To try to go down that road without actually telling the reader what he's seeing seems to me to be cheating. You can't have a scene like, Tony looked down at the body. Ah, he thought, this is clearly a person whose mother died in early childhood. I think the readers would justifiably get quite cross about that kind of writing. So I think that is part of it. I will say I have an internal policeman in my head, I suppose, that is as much stylistic as it is moralistic, saying, this is far enough. You've actually achieved what you needed to achieve. You don't need to go that bit further. And sometimes when I'm talking to my clinical psychologist contact, because I often run things past him and say, is this psychologically credible? Is this how it would be with someone like this? And he'll say, yeah, or no. And on a couple of occasions, I've said, would it be feasible that the killer would do these things? And he'll say, yeah, he would do that, but he would also do X, Y, and Z. And I just go like, no, we don't need to do that. We don't need to go there. Because one thing I will say is that whatever you may read within the pages of a crime novel, I can absolutely guarantee you that there is worse going on out there in the wild, certainly judging by what I have heard from the professionals who work in this field. And I'm just extremely grateful that I only have to deal with stuff that I make up. I don't actually have to deal with this stuff for real. And I close my door in the office in the evening and I know that nothing bad is going to happen before breakfast. You can't do that if you're a cop or a psychologist or someone who works in the emergency services. You can't do that and know that's how it's going to be, because chances are that's not how it's going to be.
Well, I would be interested, when you started to write, did you ever doubt your work, or were you just sure what I write is perfect and brilliant?
I think when I started to write, I mean, I just knew it was the one thing I always wanted to do, and I was absolutely determined that I was going to do it. I first, I suppose, formed the ambition to be a writer when I was a kid in the library. And I used to read a series of books called the Chalet School books, which, if you've not read them, they're all available here in the Bodleian, in the stacks. And they'll happily bring them up for you at the drop of a hat. And this series of books, I loved them, because one of the things I loved was following the characters through their lives. And one of the characters in the book was a character called Joe Bettany, who later became married and was Joe Maynard, and had 13 children. And in between having 13 children and teaching history at the school, I used to dash off these schoolgirl novels. I used to think, this is quite cool. And then it dawned on me as I was reading these books that this was a job. She actually got paid money for this. And I really loved the whole idea of making up stories and telling myself stories. And I suddenly thought, this is a job. This is a real job. And I suppose I sort of grew up with lots of people saying to me, oh, people like us can't be writers, or, you know, you can't make a living as a writer. And I just thought, well, we'll just have to wait and see then, won't we? And it was the one thing that I as I say, that was, I was absolutely determined that I wanted to do. I finally started, of course, when I graduated from Oxford, you know, I was 20 and I knew the secrets of the universe as you do when you're 20. And I had my attempt at writing a great literary novel, which is full of all the big emotions and all the important things like love and death and jealousy and betrayal and rage and guilt and punting. And the only thing I will say in its favour was that I actually finished the thing. And one of the things I learned from that was the importance of perseverance, just sticking at it. I wrote my first four crime novels on Monday afternoons. I had a full-time job. Latterly, I was the Northern Bureau Chief of a national Sunday newspaper. And Monday afternoons was quite a good time to write. And I'd from 2 till 7 on Monday was my writing time. And paradoxically, it was possibly the most productive time of my working life, because all week I would be looking back at what I'd done the Monday before, and I'd be thinking about what I was going to revise and how I was going to rewrite it and where I was going to go with it the following Monday, rehearsing the dialogue, figuring out the scenes. So that when I had that little bit of time, I really went for it. And I think then the third thing that makes a successful career kicked in. I mean, if you want a career in writing, I think you need three things. You need a bit of talent. You need to be prepared to work really, really, really hard and milk your talent for all you've got. And you need to be lucky. You need those moments of luck. And for me, when I finished my first novel, I was very lucky. I had the right book in the right place at the right time. Because of the success of writers from America like Sarah Paretsky and Sue Grafton, Marsha Muller, Barbara Wilson, the British publishers were desperate for something that was similar in feel, that had a UK setting. And really and truly, I think, frankly, at that point, anything written in sentences would have been published. And I had the great advantage, being a journalist, of being able to do paragraphs. So really, I was a shoo-in. And that little bit of luck was enough to get me a toehold on the ladder. And since then, I mean, I think, yeah, I think there have been key points where I've been lucky, but it's been a combination of those things. I think it's a much, much harder world today to get published in than when I started out. I think that publishers will not look at a novel, really, unless it's been agented. At a time like this, the time that we're in at the moment, of financial stringency, the received wisdom is that people will read because it's cheaper than going out for the evening. But people will only read things they know already. They'll read a writer they know already. So they'll read my book, or they'll read Phyllis's book, or they'll read Ruth's book. But God help you if you're that first-time novelist trying to get your first novel paid attention to, because people are going to go, it's a lot of money to spend, and I don't know if it's going to be any good. So it is tough. I mean, I continually, you know, thank my lucky stars that I started when I did, and that, you know, the good things that have happened along the way have happened to me, because I know how easy it is for writers to slip between the cracks. So, you know, thank you all for supporting me over the years.
More questions.
I just wanted to ask, because your novels have been so successful, whether you have any fears for your future novels and feel that you might not be able to be so successful in the future. Not that I think you won't be.
That's a really cheerful note to finish on. The answer is, like most writers, I live my life in a perpetual state of self-doubt. Yes, I mean, every book I finish, I think, is crap. I've never finished a book yet and been proud of it and pleased with it. Every time you start a book, you start with a kind of, I suppose, a platonic ideal, the perfect book. This is the one where, you know, the story's going to fall beautifully into place, where the characters are going to be fascinating and engaging, and where the prose is going to be, you know, sort of beautiful and lambent, and the whole thing is going to, and there's going to be this marvelous setting that becomes sort of part of the book and a character in the way that Thomas Hardy's Egdon Heath becomes real and part of the story. And then you start writing it, and every sentence you put down takes you further away from that ideal, that perfect book. So I never feel happy with it. When I get to the end of a book, all I can see is what I have failed to do. Every book I try to write better than I've done before. Every book I try to do something better or different than anything I've done before. And every time I finish the book, I think I have failed. And that's not false modesty, that's a genuine sense of not being satisfied with where I am. And I suppose that's one of the things that keeps me moving forward, because I want to be better, and I want finally to get that book one day that I can put my hand on my heart and say, I'm pleased with this. So yeah, I mean, I live perpetually with the sort of sense that one day all of this may end, and it might end with the next book. It's a precarious living. It's a precarious thing to do. But what else could I do? I'm completely unemployable in any other sphere of life. I have a friend who is an HR person for a big company, and she was staying with us for a while they were opening a new branch, and she did the management recruitment, the management psychometric tests on me that they do when they're recruiting their management team. We just did it for a laugh, you know, thought it'd be interesting. And she came back with the results the next day, and she said, I have never seen anything like this. She said, I have never seen anyone who is less of a team player. She said, but I've also never seen anyone who's more creative. She said, I would employ you, but only on the condition that you never came to the office. Except once a year to tell us all your good ideas and then go away again. So and that is the fear. And I'm not alone. I think every writer worth their salt feels like that. That's what drives us forward. I mean, if you asked Ruth Rendell and Phyllis the same question tonight, I suspect their answer would be very similar. Many years ago, when I met Ruth for the very first time, and I was just this little baby writer, and I didn't know what to say after I'd said, I think you're fantastic, I love your books, because like I was like, I'm just, it's Ruth Rendell, I'm standing next to Ruth Rendell, oh my God. And I said, I suppose when you've written as many books as you have, it gets easier. And she just looked at me and said, no. It gets harder if you're doing it properly. And I didn't entirely understand what she said at the time, but boy, do I understand it now.
Val, thank you for your originality, your creativity. There's no one here in this room, I think, who feels that there's any doubt about the talk you've given us tonight. Thank you so much for coming and speaking to us. Ladies and gentlemen, please let us express our thanks in the usual way.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Very kind. Very kind. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Beautiful. Thank you very much. You will be.